Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, on the web at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, editor Sandra Parks on the new book, Dispatches from Beluthahatchee, a Stetson Kennedy reader.
One of the reasons I'm so grateful that the Society has produced this book is that it presents the other multitude of issues that Stetson was involved with.
We'll discuss the Hastings Public Library, established in 1906.
The history of the library might also be viewed as the history of the community.
And we'll talk with blacksmith John Fund. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers.
I done spent my last 3 cents mailing my letter to the president. Didn't make a show, I didn't make a dent, so I'm swinging over to this independent chain. Stetson Kennedy, writing his name in. Stetson Kennedy, writing his name in.
Author and activist Stetson Kennedy is best known for his books Palmetto Country, a collection of folklore based on oral histories from the 1930s and early 1940s, and The Klan Unmasked, based on his infiltration of the Ku Klux Klan. Educator and activist Sandra Parks was Stetson's last wife and is co-editor with Susan D. Brandenburg of the new book Dispatches from Beluthahatchee, a Stetson Kennedy reader. While planning for the 40th anniversary of the Civil Rights Movement in St. Augustine to be held in 2004, Sandra Parks was asked to approach Stetson Kennedy about participating. She said she would, but procrastinated.
But one of our mutual friends, Dwight Hines, came to me and he said, Sandra, Stetson's in a bad way. His wife died 6 months ago. His health isn't good. To walk about his cabin, he has to support himself on the furniture. He needs some of your positive energy. So I thought, okay, I can do this. Well, one day a week, I had to drive my granddaughter to school in Jacksonville. So I called him and I said, yeah, I made an appointment. I came out. I arrived at Beluthahatchee at 8:30 in the morning, and at 3:30, with nothing to sustain us but sweet tea, we had talked nonstop. And so as I was leaving, I said, well, you know, Stetson, I have to drive up here every Wednesday to take my granddaughter to school. Why don't I come every Wednesday and we'll have these wonderful conversations? Well, he thought that was a fine idea.
Later that week, Sandra Parks was to pick Stetson Kennedy up and take him to a meeting in St. Augustine. Severe weather, including tornado warnings, prevented Parks from leaving Stetson Kennedy's home that night. She ended up staying at Beluthahatchee for 6 weeks, and an enduring relationship was created.
It's really hard, I think, for the public to understand how in the latter part of your life, you can find a partner that does what you do, loves what you love, is purposeful in the ways that one is purposeful oneself. But that was true of Stetson and me. And so we had 7 years together.
Sandra Parks was the biggest proponent of Stetson Kennedy's work in the last years of his life and the more than a decade since his death. The new book, Dispatches from Beluthahatchee, a Stetson Kennedy reader, published by the Florida Historical Society Press, includes writing ranging from Kennedy's college years to more recent times.
One of the reasons I'm so grateful that the Society has produced this book is that it presents the other multitude of issues that Stetson was involved with. When we got together in April 2003, we had decided we were going to set up a foundation. And when I looked at all the causes that Stetson had been involved with, we had to narrow it down to three. And those three were the stewardship of the environment, the preservation of traditional cultures, as in the oral history work that he did through the years, and of course, human and civil rights. Those three things are so interrelated that it's easier to pick out those things because those were really the big issues. He had so many interests. He had so much enthusiasm, so much purposefulness about all kinds of other issues. So Dispatches from Beloothahatchee give you the rest of the man.
While the letters, essays, articles, and other writings included in Dispatches from Beloothahatchee cover Kennedy's primary interests in civil rights and racism, the preservation of traditional cultures, and the environment, there are also more personal reflections on marriage, the process of writing, and other topics not found in his previous work. One section of Dispatches from Beloothahatchee includes Kennedy's short stories and poems. Sandra Parks.
As an English teacher myself, I don't think I would pick them out at the best poetry that was ever written about Florida, but I do have my favorites. And one of my very favorites is one of his poems that's in the book about Orange Lake. And the reason that that's so significant to me is that Orange Lake is the lake that abuts Marjorie Kanan Rawlings' property in Cross Creek. My great-grandfather was the doctor in McIntosh, and he rode across Orange Lake to tend his patients in Cross Creek. And so it's one of the few poems I've ever read about Orange Lake, and I think he did a pretty good job on that one.
Stetson Kennedy's most dramatic work came in the 1940s when he infiltrated the Ku Klux Klan, resulting in the book The Klan Unmasked. When it was discovered that Kennedy combined his own experiences with that of another FBI informant to protect that man's identity, it led to some controversy, but does not diminish the importance of the work. Kennedy infiltrated the Ku Klux Klan using the name John Perkins, unwittingly assisted by the governor of Georgia.
He was really clever about how he got into it. In those days, one could go to the governor's office and ask for an interview. And so he made an appointment, and he went to see the governor. And Stetson was posing as an encyclopedia salesman. So he told Governor Talmadge that he would be glad to give out the governor's campaign literature when he was selling people the encyclopedias. And the governor thought that was a fine idea. So then Stetson began to hang out at the joints where the Klansmen hung out. And as he began to try to cultivate the entryway into the Klan, he needed somebody to vouch for him. So he gave him the name of the governor. And the governor says, oh, yes, you know, John Perkins, that was his name. Yeah, he's a fine guy. He's giving out my campaign literature. So he was able, you know, to get into the Klan.
Educator and civil rights activist Harry T. Moore registered more than 100,000 black voters in Florida through the Progressive Voters League. Moore and his organization endorsed Stetson Kennedy's independent campaign for U.S. Senator from Florida in 1950. The following year, Harry T. Moore was killed when a bomb exploded under his home on Christmas night 1951.
When Harry Moore was murdered, he and Stetson were in contact about the Groveland Four. The story is well told in the book Devil in the Grove, which won the Pulitzer Prize, by Gilbert King. Stetson, for example, realized that, or believed, that the independent investigator that was supposed to see that these three black men then, because one had been killed, were being given a fair trial, but that individual was a former Klansman. So when Harry was killed, Stetson became extremely active in trying to bring justice. He had in his workplace at in our home Harry T. Moore's complete FBI files. Stetson sometimes believed some really screwy things about that case. The whole story is told well in the book Before His Time that was produced by the Florida Historical Society, written by Ben Green. Stetson believed sometimes stories that were not necessarily well backed up in fact. So it's not altogether a flattering book about Stetson, but it does talk about him. What moves me is that on the morning that Stetson was stricken, 4 days later he would die. But at the morning he was stricken, as we were carrying him out of our house to my car. He was taking the last steps he was ever going to take in life. He pointed to the FBI files, and he said, "Sandra, don't let them forget about Harry."
Sandra Parks believes that Stetson Kennedy's most enduring legacy is providing a blueprint for how to be an activist for positive social change.
Stetson teaches us how to be an activist. And basically, there are five things that he did that if you wanted to be an activist today, you would do. First, he saw a need that other people either didn't see or didn't believe that anyone could do anything about. For the most part, in the 1940s and 50s, it was racial integration. So first, you're sensitive to something other people aren't seeing. Secondly, you believe that you have the authority and the capability to do something about it. Most people don't believe that they have the capacity to do anything about the problems in the society that the rest of us are troubled with. The third thing is that you find a creative way to do something about it. The fourth thing is that you bring attention to it. Doing a worthwhile or worthy gesture isn't going to change anything if nobody knows anything about it. And finally, you're willing to enlist people that have similar goals to do the work with you. So if we want to make change, Stetson's given us as good a formula for how to be an activist as anything I've ever known.
Sandra Parks is co-editor with Susan D. Brandenburg of the new book Dispatches from Beloothahatchee, a Stetson Kennedy Reader. The book has a foreword by Paul Ortiz and is published by the Florida Historical Society Press.
This makes Stetson Kennedy.
This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org to find archived editions of this program, watch our public television series Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, the teaching of history and the experience of history students has evolved significantly in recent decades.
And one of the benefits of the technologically enhanced education of the 21st century is the ability to conduct meaningful scholarly research with students in a classroom setting. Access to primary source material in state and federal archives, and the ability to present the research outcomes digitally to broader audiences moves the classroom experience from the format of reading, lecture, testing, and paper writing to one in which students at every level can make contributions to scholarship. I am aware of a number of projects that span the range of historical research, and the Florida Historical Quarterly has published the scholarship from several student-centered projects. But my favorite came from the University of North Florida. The work was completed under the guidance of Nancy Levine, a professor in the Department of English. Students George V. Menton, Sandy A. Statton, Sharon Cleland, and Belinda Delzel conducted the research for an article on the Hastings, Florida Branch Library that was published in the fall 2009 issue of the FHQ. The study of a branch library in a community the authors describe as a wide place in the road might seem unworthy for serious scholarship. What could be learned that would advance our understanding of the role of libraries in public life? What indeed? Libraries were seldom found in rural communities, and the presence of a social library in Hastings, a farm community in St. Johns County, attracted the attention of the students and their professor.
And I'm sure they were probably asking themselves why a farming community of less than 1,000 people organized a library and maintained it for more than a century.
The students and their professor recognized how unique the Hastings Library was. Their work cites a 1948 American Library Association finding that 27% of the American population had no access to a library. And of that number, 91% lived in rural towns and villages. So Hastings really was unique. The St. John's Methodist Episcopal Church provided Hastings' first library in 1906. In 1928, a group of 17 women formed the Hastings Home Demonstration and Women's Club and took over the administration of the library. The name of the club tells us a lot about the structure of the organization and the philosophy behind it. Women's clubs of the period encompassed a range of civic, philanthropic, and social activities, from literary clubs to temperance organizations, suffrage and voting activities, and health and education interests. Many local clubs were members of the General Federation of Women's Clubs, which was organized in 1890. Home demonstration clubs were rural organizations associated with the Home Extension Service, an agency of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, in collaboration with state land-grant colleges like the University of Florida and local county governments. The Home Extension Service was established through the federal Smith-Lever Act in 1914. Home extension agents worked with farm women to improve home and health and to teach women how to monetize their production in things like jams, jellies, butter, eggs, and chickens for sale to a discerning consumer market. Women's clubs across the country supported libraries, but the inclusion of the home demonstration clubs in the organizational name was different and unique. It suggested a level of cooperation between town and country that set Hastings apart from other libraries.
Connie, how did the students document the role of the library in the community?
They used oral histories, club records, and newspaper accounts to document an extensive history of the library, demonstrating the growth of its collections even in the midst of the Great Depression. The history of the library might also be viewed as the history of the community. In 1937, the library moved into the town's new Civic Center, constructed with WPA funding through the New Deal programs. During the Cold War, the library shared space with a civil defense bomb shelter. The authors of the article characterized the library as an oasis of racial accord during the civil rights era, especially compared to the county's history during the 1960s, although blacks still did not have access to the Hastings Library, and the authors offer accolades for black teachers Lucy Carter, Jamie Frazier, and Nurse Britton, who taught their students to love books and value education. These teachers created home book centers, hidden libraries, if you will, to provide learning enhancement for their students. The Hastings Library became the local institution that first integrated when Margaret Stevens became librarian in 1969. The Hastings Library came under the supervision of St. Johns County as a branch library in 1977. The growth of the library collection and the deterioration of the aging Civic Center prompted a search for new space. The library moved first to the old high school band room and concession stand, but while gaining additional space, the situation was far from ideal. Cold in winter, hot in summer, and with a leaky roof, the facility was termed a hardship post by those who worked there. The next phase of the library's history proved to be a contentious one. Moving into the county library system provided Hastings Library with opportunities to apply for funding for improved facilities, but application and funding proved miles apart and evoked competing ideas regarding the best path forward. Friends of the library argued in favor of a freestanding new building. The Hastings High School Alumni Association, dedicated to saving the historic high school building, promoted a plan for reconstruction and renovation that included space for the library. Years of public meetings, fundraising, and debates finally ended with the renovation of the old high school and the placement of the library in that building. The article ends on a high note, pointing to the continued value of the library to the life of the community and the movement of the library into the digital age with the addition of public use computers. It's not hard to see the value of this project to the community of Hastings and to the students who gained research and writing skills, but who also learned to negotiate the history of conflict in ways that presented competing ideas fairly. Perhaps you'll want to take a closer look at the history of your own town library as a source for understanding the history of your community's past.
That's a great idea. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. The Florida Folk Festival in White Springs is probably best known for musical performances, but also featured are dozens of artists, crafters, and demonstrators. This year, Holly Baker spoke with blacksmith John Fund.
Each year, the Florida Department of State's Florida Folklife Program presents the Florida Folklife area at the Florida Folk Festival. Over the next several years at the Florida Folk Festival, the Folklife area is exploring how the elements, water, fire, earth, and air, influence traditions in the state of Florida. This year's theme was fire. The blacksmith relies on fire to forge their tools. While at the Florida Folk Festival, I spoke to blacksmith John Fund at his workshop at the Stephen Foster Folk Culture Center State Park in White Springs, where he gave live blacksmithing demonstrations.
Well, it's about 20 years ago when we took the class, and about 15 years ago I really got started. I'm a welder by trade, and so I'd worked with metal my whole career, but blacksmithing was not something that I thought was very worthwhile until I got enthused, and now it's what I like doing.
What's your favorite thing that you've made?
My favorite thing is making the tools that I work with, absolutely. You know, and that was the one surprise that I got in blacksmithing was I did most of my learning at a historical site. So I learned the really old-fashioned way of blacksmithing. And then when I started hanging out with other blacksmiths, I was surprised how many people didn't make their own tools. They would, you know, buy tools and use them and do blacksmithing. But if you have a pair of tongs and you don't know how to make them, you don't know how to adjust them. So I really got enthused about trying to get people to make their own tools.
Tallahassee is a hotbed of Florida blacksmiths, due in part to the many cultural institutions that teach the art, such as the Tallahassee Museum and Mission San Luis. Born in the Florida Keys, John Fund made his way to Tallahassee when he took up welding. He discovered his love of blacksmithing and apprenticed at Mission San Luis. At his blacksmith workshop during the Florida Folk Festival, John Fund hosted a live demonstration, starting with iron and a heat source on Friday morning, and building every tool in a blacksmith's kit by the end of the festival.
My wife and I live in Tallahassee, and I'm retired now, so I'm available to volunteer in the park system, and that's what I've started doing. Actually, about 20 years ago, we took a class here from a volunteer who had come from Maryland for his winter vacation and to do blacksmithing, and that's what inspired me to try and do this.
An organization that promotes blacksmithing is the Florida Artist Blacksmith Association, or FABA, which is dedicated to teaching and preserving blacksmithing in Florida. John Fund.
So the blacksmith club that I belong to is called FABA, Florida Artist Blacksmith Association. And the region I'm in is Tallahassee region. And we have a meeting on the second Saturday of every month. And so I've invited the rest of my club to come here and have a meeting here at Steve Foster. And so we'll have some forges set up out in the yard there and some anvils. And I'll be working here, but I'll have my friends out there working for the club.
So that should be quite interesting. The way our club operates is if you think you might be interested in blacksmithing, we want you to come to a meeting and check us out and possibly join. It's a family club. It's $30 a year for a family membership. And when you pay the membership for the year, you start getting the monthly newsletter that tells you where the meeting's going to be in the state. And follow us all throughout Florida. If anybody thinks they're interested in taking a class here, I've got a sign-in sheet there. When I do classes, I'm teaching how to do this, how to make tools. If you've never done blacksmithing before, I start you out with making some nails and some little hooks that are hanging right there, those little S-hooks, and right here in this middle post, the little hooks. And so by the time you've made a nail, a couple nails, and a couple hooks, then you're ready to make that tool that's hanging there. That's my punch chisel tool that you see me doing all this work with. And with that, you can make tongs or basically anything. From there, you either make it with that tool or make another tool to make it. On the other side of that post, the central post here, there's some examples of how you use this tool to punch holes and cut a piece of metal and then install a rivet. Kind of shows how you do that. Usually when I'm doing a class and a person has made their first tool, I have them do that. Cut off a couple pieces and put in a rivet just to see if it, and what you find out is that you can do it. You know, you wouldn't think you could, but you can. Most of the stuff that I do regularly, when I first did it, was really hard. You know, punching a hole in a hot piece of metal seems hard until you learn how to do it. Doing a drill press is so much easier. But what you find, or what I found, is that once you get the hang of using the tool, it's faster and it makes a very effective hole. It's really handy. It's just a matter of learning to do something you're not comfortable with. And so that's what I'm really promoting in the general public, and even in my blacksmithing fellows, a lot of them, they buy their tools and then they do blacksmithing, you know. So I tell them, no, let's make our tools, you know. And we're getting there. You know, some people in blacksmithing, I would say 40 to 50% of my club, all they want to do is make knives anyway.
To learn more about the Florida Artist Blacksmith Association, go to blacksmithing.org. For Florida Frontiers, I'm Holly Baker, Public History Coordinator for the Florida Historical Society and archivist at the Library of Florida History in Cocoa.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. Until then, find us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org and on Facebook. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Holly Baker. The program is edited by John White. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.